Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 123 of Season 8 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast, where we fubar our way through the 1998 Steven Spielberg award-winning film Saving Private Ryan, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Travis Bow of Minute of Thieves. Welcome back to the show, Travis.
Thank you. I'm going to cry if you went down the same like research rabbit hole that I went on for this minute, or if you've covered it previously. So,
well, I really hope it doesn't have to do with the first line of this minute.
Nope. Okay. Not part of the dialogue.
Good. I'm very glad to hear that. So minute 123 begins with Ryben continuing his story and ends with Miller responding to Ryan's question. So yesterday we had Ryben start to tell his little raunchy story about the super's wife, and you know he's there helping her in the changing room, and this minute begins with him saying, "I got a heart on the size of Statue of Liberty." All right, and she says to me, "Richard, calm down." And she says, "When you're over there, if you see anything that upsets you, or if you ever get scared, I want you to close your eyes and think of these. You understand?" So I said, "Yes, ma'am."
Yesterday, when Upham talks about like the, kind of the end of the song is, or may have been the first minute, he says that it's melancholy, you know. And when Ryben finishes telling his story, you know, and the implication is like, and then like the next day or, he even says at the start, like, then I went to basic training. So you know, like, what comes next. So, like, you know, he has this moment with this lady, and then he goes off to war. So I like how when he ends the story, the guys aren't, like, they're not all laughing, you know. It's not a funny moment. They're just kind of, like, taking it in, you know, like, yeah, that's when, you know, when the war started, or, you know, it's just very like, it does kind of end on a melancholy note, like that, you know, Upham was saying with the song. So, I like it. It's a weird story, you know, but, I like how it fits in this sort of, moment of the movie. So,
yeah, no, I agree with you on that. I think it's great. So I actually wanted to read a little bit from the novelization in this scene. Going back also partially to yesterday's scene, you know, where they're talking about where they're also talking about the song and stuff like that, because it's slightly different, not completely different, but it's slightly different. So, you know, back when they were talking about the chorus, so it says, "Listening to the repetitious haunting melody, Sarge says, 'What's she saying now? She said that before.' That's the chorus," Upham said. "You are speaking softly in my ear. You're saying you say things that make my eyes close, and I find that marvelous." Mellish grinned. "I'm finding myself curiously attracted to you suddenly, Upham." "Cut it out. Don't you get it? It's a sad song, tragic even." "Tragic, my aching ass," Mellish said between puffs of electric strike. "She's happy. Can't you hear it?" "No," Upham insisted gently. "Very first thing she said was, 'Then one day you left me. I've been desperate ever since. I see you all over the sky. I see you all over the earth.' Why did her lover step out? Why did her lover, boy step on a landmine?" Ryben asked. The voice, sounding so eloquent in a language only Upham understood, and him, it was elegant too, seemed to throb with sadness now. Even Mellish sensed it. Sergeant said, tossing the cigarette to the high arc into the river. "One more song from that depressing skirt, and the crowds won't have to shoot me. I'll just slit my own wrists." Horvath rose and wandered off towards the village. The rest of the squad stood or sat and smoked and thought. Ryben laughed to himself, a light little private laugh, but Upham caught it. "What's so funny?" "Nothing. Come on, I could use a laugh about now. It's just Rachel Tubalowitz is all." "Rachel who?" "Tubalowitz. I was thinking about what she said to me before I left for basic." "What? I had to beg you for the story?" "She's our super's wife. Came into my mom's shop the day I had to leave for basic. Found a few things. Ever seen Carol Landis? Didn't she that babe in the dinosaur movie?" "Yeah, well, Mrs. Trebeleski makes Carol Landis look flat-chested. Wow. She's a 44 double E easy. I'm sitting there, and she's in the dressing room with the curtain back, just enough for me to see. Maybe she did that on purpose. Maybe it was a patriotic gesture. But she asked me to hand her the side-stay silk ribboned three-panel girdle with a shelf-lift brassiere. I hand her a 38D cup, and she says, isn't this a little small? And I say, nah, that ought to be perfect. Nice. Now this is a story. So there she is with the curtain half open, and I'm watching her trying to squeeze into that thing. And she looks at me, and she sees me looking at her with the eyes popping out of my skull. And she kind of smiles and says, Robert, this is one of those moments. And I said, moments, ma'am? And she said, one of those moments when you're over there and you're scared or something terrible, you just close your eyes and see me instead. Would you do that for me, Robert? And I said, yes, ma'am.
See, I like that a lot better. Yeah. Because it implies that he's either just a, you know, he's still a perv, you know, but maybe she left the curtain exposed, you know, so that he could have that moment. But it's so much better in quotations, that he wasn't in there with her as part of like his job, you know. So
right, exactly. And I find it funny that in the novelization he's known as Robert instead of Richard.
Yeah.
You know, but you know, that could be just a slight discrepancy along the way.
I mentioned the kind of like keeping an eye on what Horvath is doing. You know, I mentioned the gun, and then he puts that away and he gets out that bag. And here we see it's a bag of tobacco.
Yes, and, tobacco.
I kind of watching him and what he does with it. Like, he's sort of the anti-Samwise Gamgee in this, because, you know, Samwise in Lord of the Rings, like, he has this really charming moment where he tells Frodo, like, you know, it's okay. I've packed our ration. I've rationed everything out that we should have enough for the return journey. And watching Horvath here, he takes the last plug of tobacco out of it, and he even like flips it over and kind of lets her little, you know, scraps fall out. Like, he's done with that tobacco. Like, in reality, it's like, well, I can get more. But it also feels like, you know, well, there's no point in saving any for later, maybe to kind of foreshadow, like, this is it. This is the last bit.
Well, he also drops a little bit as he's putting it in his mouth.
Yeah, yeah. So it's just, I never really noticed it before, never paid attention to what he was doing. But, like, but once I noticed that, it just felt very, like, you know, no point in saving it. You can't take it with you, you know, kind of idea. And then I started to think about, like, with this character specifically, one of my favorite things in the movie with Horvath is when we see him take the dirt at the start of the movie. Mm-hmm. He's got this little, you know, bag of, France, of dirt that he's
Africa,
carrying.
Italy.
Yeah. I absolutely love that idea. And as being someone who, like, you know, I mess around with gardening now, like, I hope that his intention was to bring it home and put it in his own garden, so that, like, his stuff has a, you know, grows out of Italian soil or North African soil, or, you know, I don't know if that was his intention. But yeah, it just really made me sad about the character. And, you know, it's not like
about the fact that he'll never get to his garden.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's a great little character detail. So
I like it. It's unfortunate that they never show it again. You know,
yeah, I kind of thought about that. Like, with the letter that Wade writes, or that Caparzo writes, you know, then goes to Wade, then makes it to, I think, Captain Miller, I think, ends up with, and then Ryben, I think, takes it ultimately.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's kind of, I kind of like to see maybe Ryben, like, grab Horvath's bag, you know, just to know that, like, the stuff, these little souvenirs, you know, didn't just get left behind. But
right,
yeah.
Do you know anything about the history of chewing tobacco?
I mean, not, you know, nothing. I've never looked it up. No. Yeah.
How far back do you think it goes?
Chewing tobacco. I would not be surprised if it's like the ancient Egyptians, you know, chewed tobacco, or, you know, even further probably. So I think people and tobacco, I think, have a very long history together.
It actually only goes back to the 1860s or so.
Okay, really? That surprises me. I thought it was one of those, like, you know, things that people, you know, were connected to, like tea and you know, but that's interesting.
Well, wasn't tobacco something that they only had in the New World?
Oh, maybe.
That's what I always have thought.
Okay.
I could be wrong.
I've heard of like Turkish tobacco and like Turkish cigarettes are like their own thing. It's like, and I just assume
chewing them. That's the question.
Oh yeah. I don't know about, I just assume people were consuming it, you know, in the same methods more or less. I don't know, but tell me about chewing tobacco.
Right. Well, obviously what sport do people most associate with chewing tobacco?
Baseball.
That's right. So what it says darts. Here is actually very
it's
interesting.
Darts, Rob.
That's right. So baseball, the rules of baseball were written in 1845, but the potential of chewing tobacco still was unknown at that time. the idea is that, you know, many baseball players would use it.
Yeah.
And that was before people really realized, you know, how dangerous it really could be. You know, Hall of Fame outfielder Tony Gwynn died of salivary cancer. And they claim it was it was linked to him using a lot of chewing tobacco.
Hmm.
And apparently, you know, as of 2016 in baseball, it's been banned.
Okay.
They're not allowed to use smokeless tobacco anymore due to a collective bargaining agreement.
Hmm.
There's another baseball player named Bill Tuttle who made a big name for himself because he was anti-chewing tobacco. He played for the Detroit Tigers, Kansas City Athletics, and the Minnesota Twins. And at a certain point in his life, he was an avid tobacco chewer. And he said almost every one of his baseball cards had him pictured with a bulge in his teeth. after 40 years of using chewing tobacco, he developed a tumor in his mouth that caused so much problems in his mouth that it caused problems with his teeth, his jawbones, his gums, and he even needed like his right cheekbone removed before and so basically he dedicated the last few years of his life to try to ban smoking chewing tobacco.
Yeah.
And if you did chew tobacco, that it wouldn't be it wouldn't be like on camera, so that kids wouldn't see it and say, "Oh, this is something that I would like to do."
Okay.
He ended up dying in 1998 from it, and he was part of the National Spit Tobacco Education Program, which Joe Garagiola and him, started together. Because Joe Garagiola also was someone who realized that he also got basically the quote from Joe Garagiola is, "I tell these guys, you may not like what I say, but with lung cancer, you die of lung cancer. With oral cancer, you die one piece at a time. They operate on your neck, they operate on your jaw, they operate on your throat." Not something that, and they claim that a lot of kids started using it because they would see, you know, that, you know, their baseball heroes were using it.
It was big in my high school growing up. I went to a fairly rural high school, so it was more of a lot of farming kind of community. So it wasn't really about baseball, but you know, a lot of people used it because they could get away with, you know, A little easier than obviously smoking in school.
So what do you think the five states are that have the highest percentage of high school age kids that that use chewing tobacco? This is a survey from 2009.
Okay. I'm going to guess it's all around me. It's probably Kentucky, Tennessee. I'll say North Carolina, South Carolina, and did I say, let's throw Ohio in there.
None of those are on this list.
Son of a bitch.
So going from lowest to highest, you get West Virginia. I was waiting for you to say West Virginia when you were going around.
I almost did West Virginia instead of Ohio at the end.
Yeah. So West Virginia, Montana, South Dakota, North Dakota, and Wyoming has the most.
Okay. So the big, you know, Northwest states. Okay.
Yeah. And West Virginia.
Weird.
Yeah. Yeah.
I figured, yeah, because Kentucky is like the, you know, a huge tobacco state. So is the Carolinas. So I just kind of figured it would be, you know, around that area. But
right. And obviously, what was created in many establishments because of chewing tobacco?
You mean like the spittoons? The little...
That's right, spittoons.
Yeah.
Yeah. Correct. Spittoons. So, yeah, in the late 19th century, when it was at the peak of its popularity of chewing tobacco in the West, so they... you know, someone created the idea of a spittoon, which is, you know, people would have in both public and private places where the idea was is you'd have a receptacle to go and spit your chewing tobacco in.
Yeah.
So that apparently they still have spittoons on the floor of the U.S. Senate. it's honored like an honored tradition,
right?
I don't know, maybe you still have a few senators that'll go around spitting. I don't know, I just find it a little strange that someone will be walking into a room and just like spit, and you have to be like, you have to be a really good shot, you know, to get it directly into the right place.
Yeah.
And then the scene changes. And we see that Miller is, you know, standing there in the middle, and you see his hand is once again shaking, and he actually tries to stop his hand from shaking. And as he's doing that, we see Ryan, we hear Ryan off from the side say, "Are you all right, sir?" And he goes, "Yeah, I'm just keeping the rhythm." And he starts like snapping his fingers at the same time.
I like that.
Which, you know, it's a funny way for him to, you know, it's like a psych thing, you know, when you put it in your hand and then you go like that, you know, you put it through your head, through your hair, you know, that type of thing.
Right.
Like, yeah, of course. I was just snapping my fingers. Just keep them with the rhythm.
It's kind of beyond being able to really like hide it anymore, you know.
Yeah.
So yeah, he just kind of makes a joke out of it. And
correct. How long does the average finger snap usually take?
Ooh. I mean, I would think like a fraction of a second for,
It's approximately 7 milliseconds.
Okay.
Yeah. To do a snap of the finger. And in order just to get the idea of what that really means, how long does it take to do the blink of an eye?
Oh.
So 7 milliseconds compared to the blink of an eye.
I think a snap is faster, right?
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
So I don't know. The blink of an eye is 150 milliseconds.
Okay.
No, so sorry. That means the blink of an eye is faster.
Okay.
All right. I got that backwards. you know, obviously we all know that Thanos likes to use the snap.
Which is such a, you know, it's a funny thing because like they were basing the snap off of, you know, the original comic that it came out of. But it's like if you had that power of the Infinity Gauntlet, you could do whatever you wanted without physically snapping your fingers. But it became such a big part of that, like that end battle of like, we have to keep his fingers apart. But he didn't need to actually physically snap his fingers, but they essentially made it like, you know, like he couldn't do it without snapping. I don't know. It's I love that movie, but it is kind of funny that like he could do it without a snap. You guys realize that, right?
Yeah. So obviously also Bruce Banner and Tony Stark snapped their fingers.
Yeah.
Tony Stark snapped their fingers for the same thing of trying to stop it. It's used sometimes in music as a form of body percussion.
Nice.
And there are a whole bunch of songs that have it in there. For instance, the song from Twin Peaks it's used there, and Lost Highway. And let's see if you can figure this one out. What famous 60s TV show has famous snapping in it?
Oh yeah, Addams Family.
That's right, Addams Family. Exactly. And apparently there is a subgenre of hip hop that is known as snap music.
Okay. Is that the only instrument used?
I guess so.
Yeah. Maybe just predominantly snaps. I don't know.
Don't know. Don't really know. And then Ryan continues to talk to him, and he goes, "Is it true you were a teacher back home?" He goes, "Yes." "See, that's something I could never do." You know? "Not after the way me and my brothers treated our teachers. No, sir." And Miller just looks at him and says, "I had 1,000 kids like you."
Mm-hmm. How did that story, that detail about Miller, like already make its way to Ryan, you know?
He's like, "Who's this guy Miller? Oh, he's a teacher."
Yeah. Can you believe it? You know,
this guy, he's, you know, he's this rough and tough guy. He was a teacher in real life.
I think that whole like subplot thing of like figuring out who he was in his previous life, if Tom Hanks had played it a little bit more like Clint Eastwood, where he was a gruff and grizzled, you know, kind of guy, then I could see like, oh, it's weird. Like you can't picture this guy as a school teacher, but like, yeah, I can totally picture Tom Hanks, you know, Captain Miller as a school teacher. He's not like a guy that's, he doesn't play it as someone who's been like, you know, he's not a Sergeant Rock type guy who's like bred for war and combat. And, you know, if Tom Sizemore said, "Yeah, I was a school teacher," I'd be like, "Really? You?" Yeah. You know, that would seem strange, but like, I don't know. That whole thing about figuring out that he's a school teacher, just, it doesn't seem that shocking, you know, the way Tom Hanks plays it. I don't know if they wrote it with, you know, somebody more, you know, with harder edges like in mind, and then kept it, you know, for whatever reason. But I mean, it's a nice, I like the idea of it, of them like trying to figure out who this guy is, and he's very closed about his personal life. I mean, we'll see that. I think I guess it's not in My Week, but yeah, you know, he doesn't open up in the same way that Ryan does tomorrow, you know. So, yeah, I like it, but it's kind of, I just wonder if it's if it would play better with a different sort of different actor playing the role. But I don't know. Right.
I don't know. I think wasn't this role meant for Tom Hanks? I mean, I think
I don't know. I don't know enough about the. I thought I read that this story. Or maybe I was listening to your earlier episodes in the season and said that this is one of the only projects that Spielberg didn't develop. And so the script came to both guys and they both wanted to be involved with it. So I don't know if it was written for any one person in mind. So I don't know.
Okay. No, I'm trying to remember that far back.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure because I listened to some of your earlier episodes, you know, to prepare, because just kind of see what the vibe was on the show, and I didn't know how the stuff at the end of the episodes, you know, whatever. So yeah, I'm pretty sure you said something about that. It was like the script came made its way to Spielberg and to Hanks around the same time. They were both wanted to be involved, and then they decided let's work on this together. But it wasn't written for anyone, either of those guys in particular. So I don't know.
The writer Robert Rodat first came up with the film in 1994 when he saw a monument dedicated to the four sons of Agnes Allison of Port Carbon, Pennsylvania. The brothers were killed in the American Civil War. Rodat decided to write a similar story set during World War II. The script was submitted to producer Mark Gordon, who then handed it to Tom Hanks. And it finally reached the hands of Steven Spielberg, who decided to direct the film.
Okay.
There you go. So, you know, so you're right. It got to both of them separately, and they figured out how to. There, at a certain point, Spielberg was thinking of maybe trying to cast either Harrison Ford or Mel Gibson in this role.
Okay.
I can see it, but I still think that Hanks is the best.
Oh, yeah. He's so good in this role. Yeah.
Again, it's just it's really funny that you know, Ryan, who's this like supposed to be this 18 or 19 year old kid, says I could never be a teacher.
You know, yeah. It's like, yeah.
So then he mentions the fact that he's had 1,000 students like that. So it got me wondering, you know, approximately how many years does someone like, need to teach to get?
I almost tried to do student math. Yeah.
Okay, so I tried to do it a little different way. You know, I wanted to see the average number of kids in a class.
Okay. Like specifically in the 1930s, 40s in Pittsburgh?
I tried getting around that information in Pennsylvania, but I couldn't, you know, because the data that I found only goes back to 1955.
Okay.
Okay, so according to this research, the average number of kids in a class in 1955 was 27. And then the national average in 1991 was 17. Hmm. Okay, but then now I have a different. So, I mean, if you look at it from that perspective, so let's say he had 27 kids in his class.
Yeah.
Okay. Think about how many, you know, how many years he had to have been a teacher. Again, he was teaching more than one class probably.
Yeah, because he says like English composition, but he could also be doing, you know, he could be coaching. Well, I think he does say
something. He coaches the baseball team in the spring.
Okay. Yeah. So, yeah, if you have multiple roles in the school, yeah, you could get, you know, you could have 1,000 kids, you know, in some form.
Yeah, but I don't think there are that many kids in.
Yeah.
Where is he from? Adelaide, Pennsylvania?
Something like that. Yeah. I get the sense it's a. You know, it's a small community.
Small community, exactly.
Yeah.
But, I mean, again, even
it's a good line.
Exactly. Even just doing the simple math of 27 kids in a class, it would mean that, okay, he has to teach 37 classes.
Right.
Okay. So, you know, let's say he teaches 4 a year or whatever it is. So we're talking he was a teacher for at least 10 years.
Yeah.
You know, approximately. But again, you know, you usually have the same students year after year also. You know, if you're in a small enough school. So according to data as of 2020, what state do you think has the highest average number of kids in a class?
Oh.
And how many – and what states have the lowest? So I actually have the top 5
states
and the state that has the lowest ratio, which in this case, I guess the lowest ratio is better.
No. Okay.
It's not like the worst ratio.
Yeah. For the lowest, I want to say it's either Montana or Wyoming that has like the fewest people per square mile, you know. It's like they have the smallest, not necessarily smallest population, but like the people are so spread out. I'll go with Montana for the smallest.
Okay, well, I will tell you that both Montana and Wyoming have either 16 or 16.1 or 16.2. That's the average, and it is not the lowest.
Okay. Huh.
But that is a very good guess because those are number 3 and 4.
Okay, so yeah. So what would the lowest be if it's not either of those? Oh, I guess Alaska could be on there.
Alaska's number 4. Sorry. Okay. Yeah, that fits in there before both of those that you just mentioned.
Huh, okay. Well, so I don't know then.
It was on the other page. I didn't see Alaska and Alabama at the beginning when I was checking out. Okay, so Vermont has the second lowest amount at 15.4, okay, which is tied with Alaska. Both Alaska and Vermont at 15.4. But the lowest ratio between teachers and students is in Maine with 13.4. Okay. It's the Stephen King effect.
Yeah.
Okay, so what state do you think has the highest?
My gut, you know, anytime I think of like the most people, my gut is to go New York or California. But then there's like Texas is a big state with a lot of people in it too. I'll say New York.
No, actually New York is in the middle at 19.6. Okay.
It's a big state, so it probably, you know, it right. averages out like a lot, so yeah.
And California is number 2. It's the second highest with 27.1.
Okay. Yeah. So what's number 1?
Nevada with really? 27.6.
Huh, wonder why.
I don't know. And then number 3 is Florida with 23.4, and that's tied with Michigan. Just to give you an idea for your neck of the woods, so Indiana is 19.6, and Pennsylvania, where you know, John Miller's from, is 19.4.
Okay.
I was actually also surprised that Texas is lower. Texas is 20.1.
Okay. Again, big state, so there are a lot of big, you know, less populated areas that it probably just brings down that right. average sum. So yeah.
Yeah. That's all I have for this minute. Did you have anything else?
I do. Again, unless you've already talked about, because there's a poster hanging over just past Matt Damon's character in this minute, but it was also shown a couple minutes ago. So I don't know if you've talked about any artwork.
Are you talking about the Vince Liquors, or are you talking about the Get?
The Get.
We actually didn't talk about that one. We talked about some other posters last week and the week before.
Okay. Well, good, because I went into all kinds of research on this poster that says that, you know, from just kind of watching the minute, all you can really make out is the word Get at the bottom. You can see the, you know, a clearer version of what it is, because I did find this actual advertisement. But yeah, it's you can kind of see like from in the minute, you can kind of see the it's got like two people sitting back to back. I couldn't tell, you know. Initially, I thought, okay, two men sitting back to back on a bar stool or near bar stools. But then once I was able to find it, like I didn't have much to go on other than, you know, 1940s, you know, French alcohol, or I don't even didn't even have that detail. You know, with the word Get at the bottom. I tried Google Lens, like actually just, you know, pausing the minute, using Google Lens to take it, you know, take a shot of it. That didn't get me anywhere. I was finally able to, like, I don't know, just the right combination of using the minute two minutes before my I guess last week's minutes when you see this, I was able to use that kind of image to take a picture of and use Google Lens to find that with the words un get, you know. I was able to finally find that it's, you know, this particular ad features a man and woman. At the top of it, it says peppermint allo. And then next, you know, above the guy says peppermint sec, which means, you know, peppermint with water is what she's drinking. And then he's got a small little, like a shot glass kind of size that says peppermint sec, which just means peppermint dry. So it's kind of it's a liqueur that you could drink, you know, by itself or with, you know, watered down a little bit. The other ads for this sort of this brand of liquor, some said like demandez un get, which would just mean ask for a get. that, and so it turns out like the Get is the brand, and I didn't know if it, you know, just why was it called Get, but finally I was able to figure out that it, the parent company was founded in France by Jean and Pierre Get in 1796. Production was in Revel in the Lauragais area, trademarked in 1868 as Peppermint Get.
Oh, wow.
The liqueur used peppermint oil imported from England rather than the locally grown variety. The original distillery remains in use as the town's cultural center, but production moved to Gemineau and then to Beaucaire in 1995. The company is now part of Cassanis, which is owned by Bacardi. And it's still around, as far as I know. You can get it as Get 31 or Get 27, or like the two varieties that they have.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But this actual advertisement, the poster that they that is shown here in the movie, the real poster was designed by an artist called Jules Isnard Drancy, who, according to MutualArt.com, was a Swiss impressionist and modern artist who was born in 1803. And from EnamelMasterpieces.com, goes on to say that little is known about his life, but he leaves a legacy of which Nectar Livreux is his masterpiece. He created some advertising campaign with a character called Nectar. You'd probably recognize it if you, you know, look up Jules Isnard Drancy. But yeah, just, I don't know. I was really excited to, like, you know, I just kind of got obsessed about trying to find, you know, was this like made up just for the movie, or, you know, I kind of suspected like a movie like this isn't really going to just make stuff up, you know? So I figured it was based on something from reality. I just, it just had to get there. It took a little while to finally get there. And it kind of reminded me of like when I did Watchmen Minute, there's a scene in there where Rorschach is eating a can of beans. And it's from the book as well, but in the movie, like, it took me a while, but I figured I found the can itself has a label that I didn't recognize. So it's not like Heinz or Bush's, you know. Mm-hmm. But I was able to finally find that there was this whatever the brand is now, I don't remember. It's like, it's not Green Giant, but it's like something like that. It's like Jolly Giant or something like that. But after like digging on that, I was able to find the original, you know, can art. And there was a site that was selling, like, they had original prints of, you know, various package designs and stuff. So I have, you know, in my room, I have a framed, you know, can label from that same kind of beans that, you know, he was eating in Rorschach. It's not, you know, from the movie, but it's right. From the real, you know. It still, I think, has like the crop marks to, cause it was never like in production. It was just printed, but never like went on a can. So I don't know. It's just, I like that this, I liked finding out that, you know, of course this production, like they would have had to, maybe they saw that in a photo maybe of, you know, the real, where are they at here?
Well, they're in Rommel, but it's not real. But there is real Rommel. It's a fake place.
Okay. I didn't. But probably there was some photo somewhere of some battlefield, like, you know, area like this that someone probably, you know, based this place on. And I like knowing that the production went to the effort to like get a production, you know, a reproduction of that piece and just, you know, put it on a wall. And
we've seen it throughout the movie. We've seen tons of things. Yeah. You know, that are sitting on. And I love the connection where right across the street you see that there's a liquor store.
Yeah.
So you think that it would have Get with an arrow, you know, like
right.
Go across the street.
Yeah. So yeah, next time I'm in a liquor store, I'm gonna look for you know, Peppermint Get or Get 27 or 30. I don't love peppermint, but I might try it just for the connection here.
Just to see it. Okay. Just like You know, I know that Bubba Wheat, when he did Groundhog Day, he went and you know, tasted a sweet vermouth.
You know? Okay.
He said he didn't like it. But
yeah.
All right. Excellent. So every Wednesday, we have a segment called World War II Wednesday, where my guests will give their top five World War II related films. So, Travis, once again, why don't you start off with your number five and work your way up?
All right. Number five, and you know, don't drive me out of town with pitchforks and flames. God damn it. I like Pearl Harbor.
Okay.
I do too.
I like it. I like it a lot. Not amazing, but it's a great epic movie about
action
the
movie,
story of Pearl Harbor. No question about that.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not on my top five, I'll tell you that. But okay. I do enjoy it. Yeah.
Well, like, I kind of had a hard time putting a top five together because there's like, I've seen a lot. I looked at the list of World War II films. I've seen a lot of them. Not a lot. I've seen, you know, of the ones I've seen, I've probably seen them once, you know. There are definitely some I'd like to revisit, like Atonement. I couldn't remember that Atonement was set, you know, at that time period. I would have thought maybe World War One, you know. But I did like that movie. But so some of them were like, I've seen it, but I don't remember it enough to put it in my top five. So yeah. So Pearl Harbor, I'd say Valkyrie. I really like that movie. I like Tom Cruise a lot. Then I'd say The Great Escape, which I know you're not familiar with. So no, you should check it out sometime.
Where's that one from? I've heard of it.
Yeah. My number two is it's a movie. It's just because of nostalgic value. It's a movie I watched as a kid a lot. It's called Father Goose.
Oh yeah, I've seen that. Sure.
Okay. Yeah, we watched that when I was a kid.
Cary Grant. Cary Grant. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a fun one. And then number one, it's this movie. It's Saving Private Ryan.
Okay. That is a great.
Honorable mentions to Jojo Rabbit and Fury.
Okay.
And Atonement. I'd like to revisit that one.
Yeah, I'd like to revisit that one, especially since I recently saw Blitz.
Okay.
Which has the subway scene. It has the flooding of the subway also.
Okay. Not familiar with that one.
With Blitz or with the flooding of the subway? Because you have
Blitz.
In Atonement, there's also the idea of the flooding of the subway during the London Blitz.
Like I said, I saw it once. I liked the characters in it. I don't remember that part of the movie.
Right. You probably just remember the wide shot, you know, the long panning shot of everyone at Dunkirk.
Mm. Yeah.
All right. Excellent. So would you like to once again tell people where they can find you?
Sure. I'm over at Minute of Thieves. You just search Minute of Thieves on all your social medias. I'm on most of them, I think. If not, just, you know, there's a Facebook group, the Listener's Hideout.
All right. Excellent. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. You can send me an email at movierobminute@movierob.net. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on Facebook. And you can find me on Twitter. So until tomorrow, earn this.
My solitude.